The year is 1994. My mother has just gotten into her Jeep Wrangler with no problem, which was weird because its driver's side doors are broken and have to be manually unlocked. Something feels off about the situation, but she brushes it off and starts driving, only to feel a peculiar breeze. It was then that she realized her Jeep Wrangler didn't have the doors on it. They had been stolen. She immediately calls the police about the situation and learns that the doors on her Jeep were not actually stolen. They had been used by the police as bait, as part of an operation to catch a local Jeep door thief. And I really wish I was making this up, but it's true, and it happened all without the police informing my mother about the situation, left in her doorless Jeep Wrangler, the victim of an impossible crime. Hello, and welcome to Jackie On, a podcast where I, Jackie, talk about my opinions on a bunch of different topics. This episode is Jackie On the impossibility defense and why I find it so interesting. Before getting into it, I do want to give a warning that I'll be talking about various crime and legal cases and might butcher some details for the sake of brevity. So please don't get on my case about this. Starting off, I want to talk about what an impossible crime even is. As crazy as it might sound, there is such a thing. Or, really, two things, as there are two types of impossible crime. One is factual impossibility, and the other is legal impossibility. First, let's get into factual impossibility. In the court of law, factual impossibility is a horrible defense. It never works. That is because, at its core, a factual impossibility defense is claiming that a crime was not committed, despite every intention someone had to carry it out, based on their perspective, and not the facts. Let me give you a real example from the Pennsylvania Supreme Court in the Commonwealth v. Johnson decision. In this case, a woman had decided to murder her husband by poisoning his coffee with arsenic. Only, she made a mistake and put sugar in his coffee instead. By all metrics, she did not kill him, not even close, unless she was playing the long game with diabetes. But nonetheless, after confessing to the police out of guilt, she was charged with attempted murder. Even if factually she did not attempt murder because of her mistake, she still had every intention to kill him and was unaware of the fact that the arsenic was really sugar. Factual impossibility is thus very based on attempted crime, despite there being no actual crime committed. What's important to note is that the person who commits the crime, the defendant to use legal terms, cannot be aware that a crime is factually impossible when they commit it. That's what makes it based on intention and focused on what the perpetrator thought they were doing rather than what they actually did. As you can tell, this can get quite complicated, and in some cases, it's more apparent that the perpetrator attempted murder. For example, in the United States, one of the cases that created important precedent is the 1902 State v. Mitchell case heard by the Missouri Supreme Court. Now, when I say it created precedent, it means that it was important because before it, there was no exact process or case that really examined attempted murder in such a way, or could imply whether the defense of factual impossibility should be valid and considered. Precedent can be complicated because many courts don't want to hear the same cases over and over, so they rely on precedents to form case or common law. So if the precedent is not particularly strong or built upon bias, it can make the cases that rely on it quite unfair. But let's get back to Mitchell. Mitchell was a man who was determined to kill another man named John Warren, and so he snuck up to Warren's house at night with a gun, lining up to the window of the room Warren was sleeping in, and then fired it, based on where he knew Warren would be. Only, of course, Warren was not in the room. Naturally, Mitchell was tried and charged for attempted murder. He tried to appeal the decision, but it was held that he was to remain culpable because despite not committing the crime, if Warren had been in the right place, he would have been murdered. Important to note that the factual impossibility defense is used in appeals more often than in the original case, when the defendant or some other agent feels as though the ruling on the case was incorrect. In this instance, the appeal changed nothing and instead set up the precedent that someone can be charged for an attempted crime even if the completion of the crime is impossible. Now, let's get into legal impossibility. In the eyes of the court, this is a much better defense for a crime. This is because at the core of it, nothing illegal actually happens. Legal impossibility is where someone thinks they are committing a crime and goes through the motions of it, when in reality, it was never a crime to begin with. By far, my favorite example of legal impossibility is the 1939 case of State v. Taylor, heard by the Missouri Supreme Court. In it, a man attempted to bribe a juror, which is a Class D felony. But it was uncovered that while the juror the man had tried bribing had been summoned to jury duty, they were actually dismissed from being a juror. So while the man thought he was bribing a juror, legally he committed no crime, since bribing a random person is not illegal. And while attempted bribery does exist, the actions committed by the man failed to constitute a substantive crime. So while he was originally convicted, the Missouri Supreme Court reversed the decision based on legal impossibility. Now, if these two types of impossibility sound similar, they are. However, not only does legal impossibility more successfully lead to acquittal, but it rests on the idea that acting out what you think to be a crime doesn't mean you actually commit a crime. A perpetrator needs to actually do something of a criminal nature. For factual impossibility, the actor only needs to be blind to the facts and think they are committing the crime they intend to. But legal impossibility asks us to consider the nature of the act itself. But still, these two can get kind of convoluted and bleed into each other. So, to be even clearer, under legal impossibility, someone has been able to complete all their intended actions, only these actions were not illegal. Under factual impossibility, someone has not been able to complete all their intended actions because of facts unknown to them. Let me give you a brief hypothetical. Let's say you have a fake gun, but you think it's very real and you try to kill your neighbor with it. The fake bullet leaves the chamber, bounces off your neighbor, and no harm is done. That's a legally impossible crime. But let's say you have a real gun and you try to kill your neighbor with it. Only it's a defective gun, and the moment you pull the trigger, it jams and doesn't work, leaving your neighbor just standing there. That's a factually impossible crime. Since there was real danger in the factual impossibility, you can still be charged for attempted murder, where in the legally impossibility scenario, nothing illegal actually happened. Okay, if you're still confused by the distinctions between legal and factual impossibility right now, don't worry. You're not the only one. Because even courts have been confused. The particular confusion I'm talking about occurred in the 1994 case of Booth v. State, heard by the Court of Criminal Appeals, where a man, Booth, set up a deal to buy a stolen coat. But before Booth could buy the coat, the thief who had stolen it was arrested by the police, the coat being recovered in the process. The thief and the police set up an agreement to proceed with selling the coat to catch Booth. Naturally, the deal happened and the police arrested Booth for receiving stolen goods. But this is where it gets complicated. Since the coat had been recovered by the police, it was no longer stolen. So Booth could only be charged under the attempt to receive stolen goods and was prosecuted under this by a jury in Oklahoma, at least until the Court of Criminal Appeals reversed it on the grounds that, quote, a legal impossibility precluded defendant from being prosecuted for the crime of knowingly receiving stolen property, end quote. The issue here is that the court held it to be legal impossibility, but in reality, it serves as a better example of factual impossibility, as per the original conviction, because the action was still illegal and Booth went through the whole deal thinking the coat was stolen. He was missing a key fact, but the attempt to receive stolen goods was still very much there. Now, this isn't just my opinion, but also held by R. Perkins on Criminal Law, 2nd edition, published in 1969, pages 570 to 571 to be exact. But at the same time, a very similar case to this one, People v. Jaffe in 1906, is widely held to be an example of legal impossibility. And to be clear, my man R. Perkins did not really have anything to say about People v. Jaffe. But in it, Jaffe tried to purchase 20 yards of cloth in correspondence with an employee from a company called J.W. Goddard & Son. Only, similarly to Booth v. State, the employee helping out Jaffe was caught by Goddard himself and confessed that he had stolen and was going to deliver the cloth to Jaffe. Goddard took possession of the stolen cloth back, then got the police involved, turning it into a sting operation of sorts, and then sold it to Jaffe legally. As a side note, different sources involve the police to differing amounts, but what's important is that the stolen goods were recovered and then sold legally. After buying what he thought was stolen cloth, Jaffe was charged with violating Section 550 of New York's Penal Code for receiving stolen goods, but was eventually just convicted of the attempt to receive stolen goods. Jaffe did appeal this decision, which is the People v. Jaffe case, and the conviction was reversed. Booth v. State and People v. Jaffe are very similar cases. Both involve theft and recovering of items that had been stolen to be resold in order to catch a criminal. Yet Booth v. State is considered factually impossible and People v. Jaffe is considered legally impossible. While various courts went through various rulings on both these cases, I believe the big difference to be that the owner of the stolen goods in the Jaffe case had gotten them back, meaning they were not just recovered by police and used, but fully returned to their owner and involved in a legal sale. Goddard had full authority over the cloth. This is corroborated by Judge William Bartlett of the Court of Appeals of the State of New York, who was in favor of overturning the conviction in 1906. And yes, I did read through his entire dissertation on it. It was very fascinating. Still, you can see how these cases can get easily convoluted as different courts don't agree on how they should be processed. Both Jaffe and Booth were convicted, but the decision was reversed later on. Okay, so now you know all about the impossible crime. Or well, as much as you can, considering how complicated something deemed impossible is in practice. I bring this up because I think it's incredibly interesting that from all standpoints, one can commit a crime that is impossible. Of course, when I picture an impossible crime, I think about something on a Sherlockian level. But in reality, it's only a type of crime that can somehow subvert what any individual knows as opposed to what they have planned. Take the theft of my mom's Jeep doors to catch a Jeep door thief. Technically, her doors were not stolen. They were involved within a sting operation. I'd consider this under legal impossibility, falling into the same complicated web that Booth v. State and People v. Jaffe have made their home in. And what I think is really important is that this concept is very similar to the Gettier problem. The Gettier problem, created by Edmund Gettier, challenged the idea that knowledge is formed from the three conditions of justification, truth, and belief. And as long as those are met in regards to a claim, then there is knowledge of that claim. To prove this is true, Gettier created counterexamples called Gettier cases. One of them, created by Richard Chisholm in 1966, is the sheep in the field example. You might have already heard of it, but to briefly go over it, you're staring out at a field looking at what appears to be a sheep. In reality, it's not a sheep, but something disguised as one instead, so you believe there's a sheep in a field. But it turns out you are correct, because there's actually a sheep behind the hill that's in the field. So there's a sheep in the field, you just can't see it, and what you do see might look like a sheep, but isn't actually one. So you have a justified true belief that isn't knowledge. There's a lot more complications with Gettier cases and the implications they have, but this example is particularly potent to illustrate the underlying idea behind impossible cases. They're impossible because while there is justification, in terms of justification to believe something, truth in some way, in belief and in action, there's not a crime being committed. It is a weird paradox that exists beyond simple logic and into the complicated affairs of the human-created legal system. All the components for knowledge are there, and yet there isn't any. And really, that's why I find the impossibility defense to be so fascinating. Whenever humans are faced against the concept of impossible, there is almost always a discourse to be had. Just as my mom had no one to blame for her doors being stolen, how do other victims of impossible crimes contextualize what just happened to them? Even insofar as perpetrators use the impossible crime defense, it basically means admission of guilt, of trying to cause wrongdoing, even if in some cases it's not entirely prosecutable. But the biggest thing to take away from learning about the impossible defense is that it's not something to rely on in the court of law. So if you commit a crime, first of all, don't. Second of all, don't get caught. And third of all, maybe consider the unique aspects of impossibility, but don't imagine that it will come to your defense. Thank you for tuning in to this episode of Jackie On. I hope the complicated nature of impossibility has become even a little bit clearer for you. I will see you in the next episode.